Palm Beach County prepares for its election day. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Palm Beach County has been at the center of a few presidential election controversies. It all goes back to the Hanging Chads of 2000. Have elections officials fixed the problems, especially since the 2018 election? We'll catch up on the latest. Also, child vaccinations are down, and that's raising concerns as students return to in-person classes.
The severity of illness that we've seen in the flu, and especially in a child that has not been vaccinated, is definitely substantial.
We'll talk with a medical officer about protecting your kids. Finally, numerous cities and states around the country are celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day today. In Florida, it's still Columbus Day. We'll hear from an activist in the Miccosukee tribe. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Election Day is barely 3 weeks away, and there is a sense that some folks in places like Palm Beach County are collectively holding their breath. It all goes back to that 2000 election and the Hanging Chads. As recently as 2016, the Palm Beach County's elections office was targeted in a ransomware attack. What have election leaders done to fix the problems that we have seen for the past couple of decades? And in the end, will your mail-in ballot be counted? Well, joining us now is WLRN Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus to discuss that. And by the way, we're also going to talk about the Haitian American vote and which way it'll lean in this election. Wilkin, great to have you back.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Lewis.
So elections officials in Palm Beach County, they started counting the mail-in ballots. Do we know what percentage of residents in the county are voting by mail?
Yeah, so Wendy Satora-Link says her office is prepared for the general elections as a record-breaking 70% of voters have mailed their ballots in.
70%?
Yeah.
So, and you know, Satora-Link told you that before they started, because they started counting these already, but they had to go through a logic and accuracy test last week before they could do that. First of all, what is that?
Sure. I've never heard of it until recently. Prior to each election, a logic and accuracy test is done to make sure that the machines are counting and recording votes. It's a matter of having secure elections. And so a test has to be conducted before the elections.
And so they did it. Everything is working. They started counting those ballots.
Yeah, so I spoke to her last week, but now, according to a recent press release Sunday, just yesterday, the canvassing board, local residents, and members of the media watched the test occur, and according to that release, all went well. Election officials began tabulating the vote-by-mail ballots that Saturday, and about over 450,000 vote-by-mail requests, nearly 145,000 have been returned so far.
So in the past, and this is part of the conversation you had with her last week, in the past you talked about the percentage of mail-in ballots that had been rejected. What was the percentage?
Sure. She said less than half of a percent ended up being rejected because of signatures during the primary. She says it's not a huge number, but that any number is too big. So they're essentially aiming for perfection this time around.
And it was signatures? That's it?
Yeah. Link says human signatures change through time. Certainly had me checking my own signatures as she said that. But yeah, human signatures change through time. And she says the most up-to-date signatures are on your license.
I mean, it's good to hear that barely half of a percent, you know, are getting rejected. That's not that bad. But as she said, that you know, any number is bad. And you think about the fact, I mean, we're talking about, this is the state of Florida. Razor thin margins in the elections. That's why we had a recount in 2018. What did Supervisor Satora-Link say about trying to bring that number down to zero? How are they doing it?
Yeah. And to your point, you know, Florida certainly has a reputation for that. She says they have about 10 very fast high speed tabulators. They have about 1,175 DS200 scanners. And these scanning machines are used for early voting on election day within several voting locations.
So it sounds like that it would just behoove people to get the ballots in as early as possible so that they have the time to look through and see if there's a problem. Because if there's a problem, you can fix it, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, this is a collaborative process. Despite Florida's reputation for ballot issues, she sort of reassured the public that this time around things are more efficient. At pbcelections.org, people can actually track their vote by mail ballot. And if there is an issue with your ballot, an alert will appear on a ballot status tracker. But you know, the voting block has to do their due diligence as well.
You know, you think about what happened in 2018, and of course, the governor has replaced, you know, the Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections, the Broward County Supervisor of Elections. But you think about all the issues with those recounts and the old machines. Has everything been resolved? I mean, are we looking at a different, very different election come in November?
We'll see. I mean, she says so far they've counted vote by mail ballots as soon as they came in. Their new equipment is apparently capable of doing more than one race at a time. And there is also a machine and hand recount plan. They've had the opportunity to put their recount strategy into practice during Palm Beach County's countywide and small municipal races. But she did say there is room to tighten it up to be more efficient. Her office was, quote, pleased with how it worked. And so that's what we have to work right now. And, you know, there are also 18 early voting locations throughout Palm Beach County. Folks can drop off their ballots between October 19th and November 1st. And if you want to drop off your ballot before October 19th, you have to do it at any of the four supervisor of election offices. So there is a more efficient system in terms of dropping things off. But we'll see how things go during election.
And again, just to reiterate that if you have the ballot early or if you have the chance to vote early, you can track that vote and you can, you know, if there are problems, it could be fixed so that you have some time. If you wait till the end, not so much time. I got to ask you, though, Brutus Wilkin, I'm curious as to, you know, she knows the history. She knows the history of Palm Beach County in these elections. And I mean, going back to 2000 and the hanging chads, how does she feel, though, about this upcoming election?
I think considering the fact that this election seems a bit more historic, there's more record-breaking turnout in terms of vote by mail, there is an added pressure to accomplish the goals that she and her office has. So when I did speak to her, I did feel a sense of confidence in her voice. So I think there are plans in place to make sure that things run smoothly. But again, it's Florida, and oftentimes things don't run smoothly. So I can only go by her word and the type of plans that they have in place.
And, you know, I'm not making fun of Palm Beach County. It's my home county. I grew up in West Palm Beach. It's my hometown.
Same here.
And I care deeply for it. So I want, you know, fingers crossed everything goes well. Again, I'm talking with WLRN Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus, talking about preparations ahead of the November election as the mail-in voting is well underway. And as he said, record-breaking in how many people are voting by mail this year. Let's switch things up. We're talking about the campaigns. We're not going to have the debate here in Miami, but of course the candidates still rolling through Florida. It's still an important spot for them. Democratic candidate Joe Biden was recently in Little Haiti. Now, Hillary Clinton struggled with the Haitian American vote 4 years ago. Why was that?
I mean, there are several factors. The Clinton Foundation has had a weird, complicated history with Haiti and the Haitian diaspora. 10 years after the 2010 earthquake, many policies the Clinton Foundation was involved with in Haiti, including an industrial park that was supposed to produce thousands of jobs, were widely considered as a failure. And before that, during Bill Clinton's presidency, he increased Haiti's dependence on U.S. crops, essentially destroying Haiti's rice farming. He apologized in 2010, saying the U.S. made a, quote, devil's bargain. That track record of missteps from the, you know, or by the Clinton Foundation hurt Hillary's image. And also many Haitians at the time felt like she and the Democratic Party took their vote for granted. But, you know, more Haitians voted for Clinton than Trump, but 20% of that vote went to the 2016 Trump campaign.
So how is Biden approaching this voter bloc differently? He doesn't have that history, but he does have history with Haiti.
Yeah, sure. You know, apathy is still somewhat in the air for both parties, but perception-wise, Biden is seen as someone who is not tied to the Clintons. He also met with Haitian leaders in Little Haiti, Miami, shortly after the 2010 earthquake, and it was the Obama administration's administration who started the temporary protected status, or what's called TPS. And you know, representation and messaging has also been key as well. He hired senior advisors Karine Jean-Pierre and Karen Andre, two Haitian professionals who are establishing rapport with Haitian leadership and the young voting bloc. And they're highlighting Trump's failed promises in regards to TPS to the Haitian community as a measuring stick for what they plan to do.
And you talked, you talked with Karen Andre, again, one of the senior advisors to the campaign. I wondered what they were talking about when they said this part of the campaign is this Lift Every Voice plan. Tell me a little bit more about what this is supposed to be.
Yeah, so Karen Andre says one of the first things Biden will do in his first 100 days is to stop deportation. And she says the Lift Every Voice plan aims to build socioeconomic safety net for Haitians and Black Americans. It's a, quote, racial equity push to make finance and credit available to help break down the barriers to do business and access credit and lending opportunities. Now, young voters within this sort of multi-ethnic Black community are placing a strong emphasis on financial literacy, tech inclusivity, and economic empowerment. So it isn't just about TPS. So we'll have to see what actionable items come out of this particular plan if Biden is elected president.
So we have to bring this up. There was a photo that was taken with Biden. It was at the Little Haiti Cultural Complex. Mm-hmm. And in this photo, you see Biden on one knee. That photo has been taken out of context and spread on the web. Let's clarify what actually happened there.
Well, Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles actually took that photo. And no, Joe Biden was not kneeling as the anthem was playing. Haitian performers were performing in the background, and it was actually just to make sure that the dancers were being seen in the background. But according to Jacqueline Charles, who took that photo, he was not kneeling during the national anthem.
Because some people have taken that as like the protest that Colin Kaepernick started, which is kneeling during the anthem. So again, that's, if you're seeing that, that's spreading around now on the internet. You know, coming back to what happened 4 years ago, Trump comes into Little Haiti and he tells Haitian Americans, nobody's going to do more for you than I am. Mm-hmm. What are people in the community saying 4 years later after Trump?
Well, it's quite the contrast now. Last month, the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court ruled that the Trump administration can end TPS for tens of thousands of Haitians, a move that could force mass deportations and separate U.S.-born children from their parents. To a lot of voters, even some of the estimated 20% of Haitians who voted for Trump, the failure to maintain TPS and his sort of anti-immigrant rhetoric may have hurt his chances to galvanize a vote for him. You know, but again, the voting bloc is very diverse with various political and socioeconomic interests. But that is a big blow to his campaign efforts.
And again, that TPS ended for a lot of people, and those deadlines are coming up next year. A lot to think about, and we've got barely 3 weeks before the vote. Again, Palm Beach County reporter for WLRN, Wilkin Brutus. Wilkin, always a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great one.
All right, still to come. Thousands of children have returned to schools across South Florida. Have your kids been vaccinated? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. In-person schooling is well underway across our four counties. Miami-Dade and Broward County started in-person classes last week, and they're already seeing students and faculty test positive for the virus. Both school districts have online platforms where parents can monitor case levels. For parents concerned whether their child may have gotten sick, it's hard to tell the difference in symptoms between the flu and COVID-19. Dr. Mayrenee Hernandez is the Senior Chief Medical Officer with UnitedHealthcare of Florida. We spoke with her this morning about the differences between the flu and COVID-19 in children, and we also discussed the drop in vaccinations among kids and teenagers this fall. The symptoms between the flu and COVID-19, they don't really differ in children, right?
No, but what happens is while the flu virus tends to be more prevalent in children, it's not as prevalent for COVID to impact, or at least the severity of illness to impact in children as it has in other adults. Adults that have, you know, diabetes, hypertension, and even have, you know, increasing immunosuppressive states. COVID is definitely more, it has more severe of an infection that you're seeing in that, in those, that population, where the flu traditionally, actually the more susceptible are usually the children, pregnant women and the very elderly.
Do we know if the flu or COVID-19 has a significant greater risk to a child? Does one have a greater risk to the other?
Our current information that we have on COVID, we tend to see the severity of infection in children to be a lot less by comparison to the flu. So the flu, even historically, even with a vaccination available for prevention, we've seen greater mortality and morbidity in our children, and does pose a higher threat too in pregnant women, expecting pregnant women. So there are some differences among the two viruses, but the flu itself tends to be, it targets usually the children. So it's definitely more severe in children, especially when they have not been vaccinated.
New research from the CDC found that adults that are overweight or obese are at greater risk of hospitalization for COVID-19 than a healthy weight. And they found that close to 19% of children and adolescents, or nearly 14 million kids, are considered obese. So as a doctor, you know, what concerns do you have about how we keep our kids healthy?
So the important thing there, I think, to differentiate with respect to the obesity that we find in adolescents. So it's a concomitant combination. What we did see, the adult obese patient tends to have truncal obesity, and it has a predisposition to diabetes type 2 and also hypertension. So there's it's a combination of comorbidities and chronic illnesses that exist usually in the adult middle-aged population that are not necessarily prevalent in our children with respect to, you know, the severity of onset with COVID.
So, I mean, you know, the other issue, of course, is trying to help kids stay active, but at the same time, we have to be careful and refrain from social activities. So, I mean, where do we find the balance?
I think that's an interesting question. I find that with anything in life, building a healthy routine, especially those who have actually stayed and done the completion of their studies online, is to take often breaks, to walk around, and to walk, you know, your children in open spaces, and definitely keep that social distance. We find that the same preventative measures that we've recommended for COVID apply to the flu. So things like, you know, social distancing, wearing masks, and hand hygiene. So even these are also important to prevent both illnesses. So.
Dr. Hernandez, what do we know about flu vaccination rates among kids? It's fallen compared to past years. How far behind are we?
We did see a downward trend. And this is kind of one of the reasons why we plea that the flu vaccination, even if you hadn't thought of vaccinating your child or as recommended, or even as an adult, you have questions about the vaccine, this is the year that you should actually get vaccinated. I mean, I recommend it on an annual basis and I get it myself, but it is so important that this year, you know, and there is a lot of unknowns. One of the things we do not know is when a person has had or has co-infections with both the COVID and the flu, we do not know whether this onset of a combination of two viruses in a patient can end up having a severe presentation. So if you're able to prevent one by vaccination, by basically a vaccine, we basically plea those parents and those patients to get the vaccine.
But how do you do it, considering you have a lot of kids who are learning from home, so that, you know, that pressure from schools to say your kids have to get their shots before coming to school, that's not there anymore. So how do you convince parents get the shots?
So, wow, it's interesting because the flu vaccine is available in many, many different settings. You can actually go to the cdc.org flu and you can get the locations of where you can find centers that provide the vaccine. One of the things that I find that it's convenient, for example, you don't have to wait in long lines to exposing, you know, your child and yourself to, you know, to other sick folks. But, you know, local pharmacies also offer it. So the convenience of being able to get the flu vaccine in different settings can actually make that easier going forth for this year.
Availability is there. That's true. But then why do you think there are parents who are not doing it? I mean, is it out of fear? Is it just out of apathy? What do we have to do to convince them?
You know, one of the things I think that it's important is by comparison to COVID, and at least the presentations that we've seen in children, the severity of illness, the rate of mortality and morbidity that we've seen in the flu, and especially in a child that has not been vaccinated, is definitely substantial. And historically, we do have that information. So I can understand the fear of you know, coming out and getting your child exposed to COVID. But I find that if you're able to prevent the flu illness, which can, again, it could compound with things like bronchitis and pneumonias and increase the mortality and morbidity rate in your child, I think that's the right thing to do, protect them.
I'm speaking with Dr. May Renee Hernandez with UnitedHealthcare of Florida. With children returning back to school, there are concerns about both the spread of COVID-19, but also the spread of the common flu. I wonder if that is that argument strong enough when you think about this. You know, there's this skepticism. You know it. There was a Pew Research poll that showed that right now, slightly more than half of Americans would get a COVID-19 vaccine if it was available. And that's a 20% drop from 4 months ago. So any vaccine, flu, COVID, anything, how do you convince the public of the efficacy of vaccination? Right now, there seems to be a distrust.
So one of the things, you know, as a clinician that I have found is, you know, talking to your doctor about the pros and cons, right? Your child may, or even, you know, yourself may have underlying conditions that may not lend itself to a vaccine. It is not a live vaccine. So this is interesting. So that's also important to know. There's different methodologies of applying that vaccine and knowing what is the best outcomes for your child. The signs and symptoms of a flu vaccine is usually localized pain to the injection site. But if you look historically, you know, just even in 2018, the mortality and the deaths that we saw were substantial, and mostly in children from the flu. So I find that the flu vaccine has been something that has been in effect year over year, and it is tailored to the most common subtypes year over year for that reason. And again, the adverse outcomes from the use of the flu vaccine has been very minimal. By comparison, for example, and I think, you know, maybe the public, their biggest concern is the unknown. Well, as far as, you know, from a clinical perspective, the flu vaccine has been known to decrease that mortality and morbidity that getting the flu viruses entails. A lot of times people fear when they get the flu vaccine because you hear anecdotal cases to say, I ended up with the flu days after I got the flu vaccine. One of the things that we have to educate on as clinicians is that a vaccine, your body takes some time to build antibodies. We are not giving you antibodies. We are giving you a modified antigen. So your body is able to ramp up its immune system and develop antibodies. So when you inject a child with a flu vaccine, you'd still have to caution about 5 to 7 days not to get exposed to others that are sick within a household or within their environment.
Kids, usually you're getting quite a bit of vaccines early on, and some of them aren't getting some of these vaccines. I want to talk about the measles specifically. What's the danger of getting the measles, and why is it on the rise again?
Yes, so it's interesting. So we've had the recommendation for what we call the MMR. It's actually three diseases in one. So it's very convenient. Instead of, you know, I know a lot of parents just, gosh, they get so many shots, right? Especially when they're so little. Well, it has, you know, it's been recommended that it loses after the, you know, 10 years in effect, it may lose we may lose those antibodies that we've made to the vaccine known as the MMR. So the presentation of the measles, mumps, and rubella is actually, you know, a lot worse. They do carry, you know, your child always sick, and they carry also complications. You know, even in an adolescent, for example, you know, it's interesting. A lot of folks don't realize that mumps, for example, in a young adolescent male can preclude actually infertility later on in adulthood. Why not prevent, you know, a disease that with a vaccine that it's three diseases in one, protect your children, and especially those you know, that are coming back into the college dorms. You know, it's so important to update and the recommended MMR dosing in these folks.
That was Dr. May Renee Hernandez, Senior Chief Medical Officer with UnitedHealthcare Florida. You can read more about vaccinations for the flu and the impact COVID-19 can have on children by going to our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, we're going to hear from an activist and artist in the Miccosukee tribe about the history and meaning of Indigenous Peoples Day. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. 14 states and the District of Columbia have changed today from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. Florida is not one of them. Dating back to the late 1970s, there's been a push from Indigenous rights activists to change the federal holiday. Some cities across South Florida, including Lake Worth Beach, have proposals to change the name. Indigenous Peoples Day comes as protests across the country have forced communities to reflect on the nation's racist history and the individuals that we choose to memorialize through monuments. Joining us now is Houston Cypress. He's an activist, artist, and man of faith with the Miccosukee tribe. He's on the board of directors of Love the Everglades Movement and a member of the Unity Coalition, a nonprofit supporting LGBTQ rights. Houston, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's a beautiful day, and it's nice to be visiting with you. How are you doing today?
Oh, fantastic. And with that greeting, I'm feeling great. Thank you so much. You know, the protests that we've had over these last few months for racial justice, they've been historic. But, you know, I mean, Indigenous communities have been protesting police brutality and racism for generations. So how do you see the struggles of Indigenous populations connected to everything that we see going on right now?
You know, I think I always like to talk about how in many ways it's a beautiful struggle. But sometimes that struggle can take on these very horrific forms that we're seeing, not only from the response to people standing up for themselves, but just the kinds of histories and cultures and cultural practices that are lost because of the violences that are inflicted on these people, our peoples, our friends and families over time. So it's a beautiful struggle. And I also like to remind us that that the reason that we're struggling for these things and fighting and showing up for each other, not just for Indigenous people, not just for our siblings in the Black community, but we show up for each other because we're struggling for joy. That's what we do in terms of my community, Miccosukee, when we get together for our ceremonies and celebrate our own special holidays, and why we're trying to save the Everglades, because of the joy that is inherent in the land.
You know, I've never heard it that way. I'm wondering, you know, how do you describe, what do you mean by that when you say beautiful struggle?
Well, you know, what I mean when I say beautiful struggle is that for me, I've grown up in the Everglades, and I became an activist for Everglades restoration because I realized that my cultural practices are tied to the thriving of the Everglades ecology. And so growing up in a place that I can't live off the land anymore, like I grew up hearing about stories of being able to hunt, seeing the birds block out the sky because the flocks were so big, and just being able to live off the land, that's not possible much these days anymore, like unless it's in a very limited fashion. So that beautiful part is the continuation of the culture, speaking the language, and connecting with the universe in our own spiritual ways. But the struggle is just the struggle of trying to survive in a place that's environmentally degraded, where our voices are marginalized or dismissed. And so that's the struggle part. And also the struggle is just trying our best to build coalitions so that we can show up for each other and support each other's movements for joy.
Again, a very different way than anything I've ever heard. Very interesting way to look at it. You know, today, as I mentioned, is in many places it's known as Columbus Day, but in a lot of other places it's Indigenous Peoples Day. How do you see and define Indigenous Peoples Day?
Well, earlier you were talking about how Florida doesn't recognize it, but you know, there's actually a state holiday that they have here called American Indian Day. It's a state holiday that happens, I think, on the last Friday of September. And I know that my community likes to celebrate it by inviting folks over, the general public over, to learn about our culture and in the Everglades. But that's something that already exists here. But in the broader picture of things, like, I'm also a part of a decolonization movement that's known as the Two-Spirit Movement, which is about gender diversity. Mm-hmm. And that's a movement that started around 1990 because we were trying to replace problematic language that was describing the gender diverse people. And so that 1990 was a pivotal year internationally because there were discussions all around the world, in the United Nations and in other places. And that was around the time where this idea of Indigenous Peoples Day started. But the reason we're doing that, again, is because of the erasure. Like people, so like I get from people pretty often in my daily life, like, oh, you guys still exist as Indigenous people, as Indians, as Miccosukee or Seminole, like, do you still exist? And so, yeah, we still exist. We still thrive. We still cultivate our gardens and have our ceremonies and our songs. And we also build coalitions and support each other, like other Indigenous communities. So I think that this movement of Indigenous Peoples Day is a beautiful thing. And I don't think it's something that's meant to be disrespectful of other communities like Italians and Italian American heritage, because I, as an artist, am very inspired by those traditions, especially the artistic and philosophical traditions that have taught me so much as an artist. So I think there's room for everybody to celebrate their history and their culture. But it's very vital that the Indigenous perspectives are centered and highlighted because of the erasure that we have been enduring for so long.
So do you observe the, I mean, well, you said that you have events, you invite people to come to learn more about your culture on American Indian Day. But does that mean that Indigenous Peoples Day, that's not, do you observe that at all?
And yes and no. Yes and no. Yes, because I think it's an opportunity to center, again, Indigenous perspectives, because we just don't hear too much from our Indigenous hosts, our Indigenous neighbors. But no, because every day is Indigenous Peoples Day, and I don't need official sanction to be able to practice my culture, to speak my language. But in the broader context of the nation and the kind of discussions that we're having, it is necessary. It is necessary. But on a personal level, for me, every day is Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm just a fabulous Miccosukee diva every day.
I like that. You know, I mean, you know as well as anybody. I mean, in schools, we're taught about the European colonizers like Columbus, Ponce de Leon. And, you know, these men are memorialized, you know, in statues and so forth. How do you teach and talk about U.S. history with young people in the tribe?
You know, I think one of the things that I like to highlight these days in my artistic and spiritual practice is the idea of gender diversity. And even though that's not a tradition that is that comes from the Miccosukee ways, it's a tradition that is honored by a lot of other indigenous communities. And so when we look at the history of gender diversity in a lot of other indigenous communities, we've seen official state policies, church policies, community policies of dispossession, people being moved from their homelands, people being shamed for practicing their languages and their cultural ways. And so a lot of it is also about healing practices too, because the kinds of traumas that these dehumanizing practices inflict on our communities last over generations. So we got to look at some hard facts and hard history, but we also got to remember that we're not about circulating these traumas as well. Eventually, we want to get these traumas out of our communities. So it's not about re-traumatizing people, but it's about offering each other the support that we need to stand on our sacred ground.
So you talk about that, you know, the not wanting to revisit that trauma, but what do you think about the fact that, you know, especially because, again, of these protests that we've seen over the summer, that dozens of Columbus statues across the country were either vandalized or removed, including the one here in Bayfront Park. It was vandalized. What do you think about the statues, and who should we be memorializing?
You know, I think that's a big community discussion that we all got to have together. But my personal opinion is that you know, there's probably better ways of removing these monuments rather than defacing them, so that we can continue to not forget these histories. Maybe we can remove them and have a special museum for these kind of places, for these kind of monuments, and talk about it that way and learn from these lessons and learn from these mistakes of history. Far be it from me to dictate how other people should reorganize their own communities, especially in this cultural rebirth that we're witnessing with these protests.
You know, one of the arguments that I heard is that you leave the statues up, but you put a lot of other statues around it and give the true historic context. Like, if you kept the statue of Columbus, but why not have statues of Miccosukee, Seminole, and other indigenous people leaders up there as well, and say, history is a lot bigger than you think?
That's a pretty cool idea. See, like, that's why we need to get together and not be afraid to talk with each other. And that's why I always remind people, like, invite each other regularly. Invite us, invite me, I'll invite you. And I think that's kind of like why I'm working so much in the nonprofit sector these days with the Unity Coalition and with the Love the Everglades movement, because I want to invite people to connect to these Everglades. The land has so much to teach us already. And so, let's have discussions around these issues and let's find solutions as a community. I think that's great. You got great ideas, man.
Oh, I'm not going to take credit for that. I've heard other people say that, and I just wanted to bring that forward. But again, I'm talking with Houston Cypress, an artist, activist, a man of faith from the Miccosukee tribe. We're discussing Indigenous Peoples Day and the fight for Indigenous people's rights. But we're going to talk about a lot more than that. By the way, you can read more about Houston's activism and work with the Unity Coalition and Love the Everglades on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Houston, I wanted to ask you about, how the Miccosukee have approached this pandemic. How has the tribe dealt with the lockdown and quarantine and everything else?
You know, again, you got to, like, for reasons why, I definitely recommend asking the tribal leaders and officials themselves directly. So I'm just going to tell you, like, what I'm looking at from my perspective as a community member. And so, like, how are people dealing with it? Well, we take it very seriously. My community, my extended family of the Miccosukee tribe, there's about 600 plus people in the community. And everybody is a cultural resource, especially our elders. We don't really write our teachings down, our spiritual teachings, or our cultural teachings, our traditional ecological knowledge. We don't write it down. All of that is stored in the hearts of our community. And whenever we lose somebody, we lose encyclopedias of knowledge, centuries of knowledge that have been accumulated in these people. So that's why we take it seriously, man. The community's in lockdown. Only people that need to come in, come in. And we're mourning the loss of elders today. Even though there's a political and cultural separation and distinction between Seminole and Miccosukee, Seminole people just recently lost a prominent elder. Miccosukee people have lost prominent elders in recent times. And so there's a lot of sadness around that. And that's why we take it seriously, to protect the community, our families, and our loved ones.
You know, something you just said is that you passed the history down, not written, but just from, you know, through the heart, but through people. And I'm wondering, why is that? Why not write it down? Is it, wouldn't you protect it more that way?
Yeah, it's alive within you that way. It's a tradition that connects you through storytelling, through song and dance, back to the beginning of time, back to the creator, back to the breath maker. And so when you have something written down in an object, maybe the object burns, maybe the object disappears or whatever. But if you keep this knowledge alive within you, then that's, I think, more meaningful and a little bit more special, too.
You know, you talked about there has been loss, and I'm sad to hear that you recently lost a leader in the community, a medicine man. He was a children's doctor. How are you honoring his memory?
You know, I think the best way to do that is to continue to keep our practices alive. And there's special things that are done, and we don't really normally talk about these things in public, but just to kind of say that the best way to honor our elders is to keep these traditions alive. And for us, I think, and for me and my family, that's about staying connected to nature, keeping our family units, our extended family together, and honoring our spiritual principles too, the kinds of spiritual principles that were passed down traditionally. But for me, like, my practice is more interfaith and multi-faith as well. So that's why I'm open to sharing a little bit more than other people are. But those are things that are very special and private for the community. So that's why I really don't get too much on details of that.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to come back again to how the tribe has dealt with this pandemic and how it's affecting everybody's lives. But one of the things about your community is that, you know, look, you depend on tourism too, because you have tours of the Everglades, people visiting the Miccosukee Indian Village. How have those businesses, you know, dealt with the spread of the virus?
Well, I think I'm proud that our leaders take this seriously, and I'm proud that our leaders are consulting, like, the experts, state and federal experts. And so when they issue guidelines, we take these guidelines seriously and try our best to implement them. That's what I'm seeing in the community. In terms of businesses, like, some of my friends who operate, like, airboat companies and airboat rides, they don't take walk-up business anymore, but they will take, like, reservations. They call ahead and reserve a spot. Definitely wear your masks and things like that. And then other businesses have not opened up at all. So things have been cut back, have been reduced, have been refined, all in ways to try to protect the community, but also still finding ways to keep revenue coming in as well. But I think that not only is the Miccosukee health a priority, but we want to respect the health of our visitors as well. So, like, that's what I see my friends and family in the community doing as they slowly open up businesses or try to keep them running.
Yeah. Houston, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your advocacy, you know, for the LGBTQ community through your work with the Unity Coalition. There is a special drive-in film screening at the Desertland Park this Wednesday night. Tell us a little bit about the film Two Eyes and a little bit about the group, the Unity Coalition.
Cool. Well, check it out. Like, that's why I'm so excited to be a part of the Unity Coalition. I joined up with them about a year ago. And so as a part of the Hispanic Heritage Month, Unity Coalition has been putting on Celebrate Orgullo since 2011, and it's an LGBTQ pride event for Hispanic and Indigenous communities. So our celebration started on October 1st, and it's going to culminate on Wednesday with the drive-in movie. But it's not just a movie. The film itself that we're premiering, the East Coast premiere of Two Eyes, the director is a gentleman named Travis Fine, and he showed it out in L.A. about a month and a half ago. And it's a pretty cool piece of cinema. I'm a filmmaker myself, so I really enjoy great films. And this film tells three stories in one over three different time periods. But what combines all these stories together is about the journey of people finding out and redefining and recreating who they are. And so, like, there's actually an indigenous storyline as one of the three stories that highlights the Two-Spirit people that I was talking about a little bit earlier. So I'm really excited for it. Part of the festivities of that drive-in night, we're also going to be giving out awards to some shining leaders in the community, including Miss Florida Seminole, Durante Blaze Billy. And so it's going to be a party. It's going to be a drive-in, so you can stay safe in your car. Come check out the film. Come check out the award ceremony. And we got some goodies to share with you, too. So if you come and join us, we're going to make sure you have a good time, respect your safety protocol, and learn a little bit about Indigenous culture, gender diversity, and celebrate with us some of the leaders in the community at Unity Coalition.
And you started to touch on a little bit, too, because just coming back to the film, it looks at this meaning of being Indigenous and queer, including the concept of, and I hadn't heard this before, two-spirited. Help me understand that.
Sure. Well, again, the film tells three stories. There's a two-spirit character, there's a transgender character, and then there's somebody who's non-binary. So it's really about gender diversity. But to focus on two-spirit, there's communities all across Turtle Island, which is the name for the North American continent, and then other communities respect the land by calling it Abya Yala. And so all across the land, there are different indigenous nations that have different ideas of gender. Gender is about our role in the community. So what are the duties and responsibilities that we have to our community traditionally? And so Two-Spirit opens up a space for the gender diverse, people that are masculine, that are feminine, that are in between or beyond, non-binary. And so you really got to learn and make friends with indigenous people to have a better understanding of that. But it's a healing movement, because so much of these gender diverse practices had to go underground or disappeared. So we're finding ways to respect each other in community and still honor our duties to our people and the land. So I think those are some of the ways I interpret Two-Spirit gender diversity.
You know, I wanted to ask you, too, about this. You think about everything that we're seeing in the time that we're living right now. And, I mean, you know, indigenous populations have been through so much in the history of this country. How do you view and how do you view and you think about and talk about everything that's happening right now?
You know, I think I look back to the fact that in 2009, the U.S. actually apologized to the native peoples of this land. So whether we know it or not, we are in an American context of reconciliation. And I think that that's a movement that has to be community led. So that's why we're seeing the rise of these public ceremonies known as land acknowledgments. And I think all of that is great. But there's a lot of work that we have to do, and I'm really looking forward to seeing this work flourish across the lands, because Indigenous people are our neighbors, are our hosts, and we have so much to share and celebrate together. And I think those are some ideas that I like to share.
You know what? Definitely, as you said, a lot of work to do, but I'm going to keep going back to what you said earlier. I think it's a really great way to view it. It's the beautiful struggle.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that beautiful struggle is wonderfully expressed through the arts. And let's continue to collaborate artistically and spiritually where it's appropriate. That's why I like to do interfaith and multi-faith. Sometimes it's appropriate for us to come and pray together. And sometimes we got to do that like in our own spaces privately. But I think those are some ways forward. And let's see what we can do together, man.
Houston Cypress, artist, activist, person of faith with the Miccosukee tribe. By the way, we've included information about the screening of Two Eyes at Desolin Park. It's on our social media.
Yeah, come on out.
Yep.
It's going to be great. Wednesday night at 7 o'clock.
All right. And if you want to know more, you want to mark that down on the calendar. We have it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Houston, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much for the time.
I appreciate you. Have a great day.
All right. You as well. Well, that's our program for this Monday, October 12th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, there are a number of school board races across Miami-Dade and Broward County. WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman is meeting with candidates, and she's going to give us an update on their platforms and also how the return to school during the pandemic is impacting the races. Plus, look, I-95, a lot of us in South Florida, we know it well. We've been on that road plenty of times. That road stretches all the way up and down the east coast of the United States, but there was an investigation from reporters at the Sun Sentinel that found that 30% of the fatal crashes on that road stretches from Maine, the state of Maine, to Florida. 30% happen here in the Sunshine State. We're going to explore some of the reasons why, and we want to hear about your experiences driving on I-95. Finally, what if you could support local artists and get regular pieces, specialized art just for you? We're going to hear about Commissioner. It's a program and how it's creating this ecosystem in the local arts community when many artists, are struggling to sell their work during the pandemic. You can actually help. All of that is coming up tomorrow on the program. As always, remember you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.